Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A sociology course called White Racism is being taught at Florida Gulf Coast University this spring. You may have heard about it. We've talked about it before, and it's made national headlines since the announcement of it being offered. The controversy surrounding the class has led many to question the course curriculum, including the required textbooks. The main one, chosen by the class's professor, Dr. Ted Thornhill, is entitled Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism, and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America. The book's author is Dr. Eduardo Bonilla Silva. He is the president of the American Sociological Association and a sociology professor himself at Duke University. Dr. Bonilla Silva joins us now to talk about his upcoming lecture here at FGCU. It's called The Continuing Significance of Color, Blind Racism in Trump America. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
We are talking with Dr. Eduardo Bonilla Silva, the author of the textbook used in the controversial white racism class at FGCU. You can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So first, Dr. Bonilla Silva, can we start at the beginning? What exactly is colorblind racism?
Colorblind racism is the new prejudice, the prejudice of modernity. So if you think about the Jim Crow arguments and language that we used 50, 60 years ago, it was a more in-your-face racial discourse. We use names that I'm not going to use in public radio, but we all know the words of the past, and it was overt, clear. The contemporary way of talking about race, for the most part, is a sort of slippery. Now you see it, now you don't. I'm not a racist, but... So my best friends are black, therefore I can say all kinds of things about black people, because after all, some of my best friends are black. So by colorblind racism, I mean the new way we talk about race. And we don't need to use the terms of the past to continue talking about race, yeah?
So you don't have to use the derogatory terms in order
for race
to...
You cannot. Let me give you one example. I can say, I am all for equal opportunity. That is why I oppose affirmative action, because affirmative action is reverse discrimination. So that statement is seemingly race neutral, except that it only works if you believe that discrimination ended. And we have clear data that discrimination in the labor market, housing market, etc., continues. Therefore, claiming that you are all for equal opportunity and classifying affirmative action as reverse discrimination is a silly argument, yeah? But pro forma, it looks like race neutral.
So if someone means it and they're saying, I don't really see color, and they are treating everyone equally in their orbit. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, if someone claims not to see color, I am selling these glasses, correct for color blindness, for $19.95. No, seriously, we all see color. This is not, we cannot control that. In a racialized society, we all see color, period. And the issue is not seeing color, it's what we do with the scene of color, yeah? So having a theoretical claim that you don't see color when a lot of the people who claim that live in white neighborhoods, have all white friends, send their kids to white schools is problematic, yeah? I am colorblind, but all my networks of life are white, but I don't see color.
Because it's not there.
Because it's not there, yeah.
So how does your textbook lay this out for students? How does this book tell the story for college students?
Well, I'm going against the current, yeah, because in the common sense on race is that we know who the racists are, yeah? This last election cycle gave us a sense of how we classify and analyze race matters. We assume that the problem of race is the quote-unquote racist. We assume that the racists are those uneducated, poor white folks. And my claim is much larger because systems of domination, whether based on race or class or gender, have these ideological formations. We all participate of them whether we like it or not. So in truth, the colorblind drama is played in corporate America, in colleges, in jobs, and it's not exclusive to working class whites. Yeah.
Can you explain to me then, give me an example of what you're talking about a systemic racist issue that maybe when you, in maybe a chapter of your book where you lay it out. So this is a fact. This happened here in this situation so that it
so
helps to teach it.
Let's talk about, for example, housing discrimination. Yeah. And housing discrimination is not driven by the Klan. Yeah. In the past, 50, 60 years ago, the techniques of excluding people of color from certain neighborhoods were in your face. You could have a housing covenant. You could have a bomb. Literally, someone would plant a bomb, redlining and things like that. Today, there are more sophisticated ways of accomplishing the same task, such as realtors showing different neighborhoods to different people. Yeah, and we call that steering. And we have data that realtors do steer certain people into certain places. Or banks make decisions about financial about loans based on color, not on the score credit of an applicant. And again, we have data on that, and plenty of banks have been legally prosecuted for discriminating. Yeah. So the beauty of that discrimination is that it's not in your face. So you can go to a transaction in which you receive a loan offer that is worse than you expect, and you may choose not to accept it, or if you accept it, you're not paying more than a white applicant. Yeah. So the problem here is that the victim of discrimination may not even know that he or she is discriminated. For example, when I applied in 1984, I was looking for an apartment in Madison, Wisconsin, liberal Madison, Wisconsin, and the person that I asked for about an apartment told me, okay, in order for you to get this apartment, you need to give me 2 months in advance rent and a security deposit 1.5 times the amount of the rent. So I'm like doing my count. Okay, 400, 800. Jesus, I'm sorry, I cannot do it. I'm like, okay, sorry, you know. Later on, I discovered that he was asking that only for me and not for white applicants. Yeah. Again, the beauty of this is that he didn't call me any name. And unless I have data from a white person telling me, wow, I didn't get that treatment. He told me the standard is, according to the law in Madison, Wisconsin, 1 month security deposit. You don't have to pay 2 months in advance, yeah?
Wow. I've always heard first and last. But yeah. So you've probably heard that the white racism class, the professor, Dr. Ted Thornhill, he's received a book-length amount of angry, often cruel, and many times racist emails, and more than a collective half-hour of voicemails about the class. And when they're not calling him the N-word or wishing him stage 4 cancer, many of the complaints are rooted in this idea of colorblindness. People are angrily saying, hey, I'm white and I don't see color. I was raised to treat everyone the same and I'm raising my kids the same way. Yet they're offended by a class like this. What does that say to you as a sociologist?
They should all first buy my book. No, really. They should take his class. Ted Thornhill is a formidable professor. All his students love him because he cares, he's passionate, and he's knowledgeable. So the people who claim that the problem with the class is calling it white racism don't know that we in sociology, we in the social sciences, make a distinction between prejudice, and we all can be prejudiced, and racism, meaning a system that gives systematic privilege to some people at the disadvantage of others, yeah? So, for example, during slavery was a racialized system. It was white racism. Do you think that enslaved Africans didn't hate white people? Probably most of them did, yeah? So on the prejudice level, they were prejudiced against whites, but they didn't have the power to have a slave system in which whites were enslaved, yeah? And today, I contend that the system, the society that we live, is still sort of systemic white privilege, you know? By the way, the term white racism was not invented by Professor Thornhill. It comes from the discussions and struggles of the 1960s, and the first time I saw that in a book, it was by a white professor, Professor Joe Fagan, former president of the American Sociological Association. So it's interesting they're targeting him. By the way, a lot of the people who target him and claim to be colorblind also then call him all kinds of names. So it's a strange way of being colorblind when you say, yeah, I don't see any color, but I hate you, N person.
Yeah, that's kind of how they sounded. But some of them sound like they take it personally, the idea that they're going to call that he's talking about white racism as an actual thing. They want to say that, well, what about black racism? What about this?
But and that's what I said, that they have to then
Power to.
And they have the power, yes. And for the less informed members of the community, it would be nice if we have a civilized discussion about, okay, let's make a distinction between prejudice. And I'm sure that Professor Thornhill and I would agree. Prejudice is not the prerogative of white people. Black people can be prejudiced. Latinos can be prejudiced. But having the power to create a social system that gives systemic advantage to black or brown folks, we have not had that. Theoretically, I would say plausible. Likely? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of there were some people at FGCU that were upset because we had some signs cropping up around campus saying it's okay to be white. The signs popped up on campus again this year, and the person who posted them said out loud that it was specifically to send Dr. Ted Thornhill a message after his white racism class began the week before. He wanted to say, it's okay to be white. What, as a sociologist, do you think drives a young college student to post something like that?
These are peculiar moments that we are living, yeah? And it's funny because historically, most white people don't like to be called white, including, for example, the title of the course being called white racism. So it's interesting that in this moment of agitation and nationalism, then why a segment of the white community wants to be called white and be recognized as white folks, yeah? So that I found interesting and provocative. But I think that there is a social force of white ethno-nationalism, yeah? Of a segment of the white community that has been left behind, that is quite angry. And I personally, I don't engage the politics of vilification. I am about building a new society, and I'm willing to engage and do politics and engage with everybody. So I think that the so-called liberals who then want to vilify poor whites and call them deplorables or call them racist are missing the boat. I want to have an appeal to everybody. Yeah, to try to change the way that they think and act. And ultimately, poor whites have more in common with the black and brown majority than with the white elite. So politically, I want to be able to have a conversation with those students. And I may not be able to convince them, but I think that ultimately my job is to try to engage, agitate, educate, yeah?
So here's a question, and I earnestly ask this. When you are confronted with a person that is saying, that's angry about this course, how do you begin that conversation with that person that's already feeling defensive? I mean, how do you get that conversation to go beyond, settle down from the shouting match, and have somebody actually hear you talk? I know you're not necessarily maybe a facilitator, but as a sociologist, what kind of things can you point out, or what kind of ways can you present an educated point of view that can be heard by one of these, a person that's feeling defensive like this?
Obviously, they're different. There are people that, I want to educate, I want to illuminate, but I also don't want to be silly. And if someone is with a gun.
Well, yeah, we don't want to do that.
I don't want to be.
We just don't want to escalate anything, yeah, but how do you de-escalate that, by also offering information?
I think that, for example, someone comes angry at me about, what about black racism? I'm like, let's be honest. I agree with you that there is black prejudice. Some black people hate white people. Now, I also know the data. Prejudice data shows that black people are less likely to be anti-white than white people are to be anti-black. Yeah? So I have that data. So data is important. It's not all, but I want to have the conversation by first acknowledging that black people can be prejudiced. Now, if by racism we mean a system, that produces systemic advantage for people of color over white people, show me. If that were the case, we would be in charge of everything, yeah? We would have the best jobs, make the most money. I mean, every time they tell me, what about Oprah? Come on, for every Oprah or LeBron James, a lot of poor people of color. So as a sociologist, I don't look at the exception, at the outlier. I look at the trend. And the trend is that we tend to get worse jobs, make less money, and be at the bottom of society in all kinds of indicators.
We're talking with Dr. Eduardo Bonilla Silva. He's the author of the textbook used in the controversial white racism class at FGCU. And you can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 239-590-2580. So you're going to be giving a talk tonight, and I want to specifically focus on the colorblind. It will specifically focus on colorblind racism in relation to what you call Trump America, all one word. How have things changed since Donald Trump took office?
It is a peculiar last 10 years in America, yeah? We moved from Obamerica, and I also used one word,
Obamerica,
Obamerica.
Okay.
To Trump America. We moved from the dominant narrative 10 years ago that we were moving to a post-racial America to a narrative that now says that old-fashioned races are in charge, yeah? So we moved from we shall overcome to, wow, the Klan is in charge. And I think both narratives are wrong. So my talk tonight will be trying to decipher the moment, the juncture that we are experiencing, and saying that despite the clear rise in old-fashioned racism, yeah, despite the Steve Bannons of the world, and despite the comments from President Trump, the old-fashioned racists are not in charge of pushing forward systemic white privilege. So the example I gave you about neighborhood segregation or jobs or anything, it's not poor whites who are in charge of driving race matters in America, yeah? They have their thing on the side, but they are not in charge, yeah? Even with Trump being president and the comments he has made every now and then against Muslims, Mexicans, and more recently against the entire continent of Africa and Haiti, I think that the bulk of racial affairs is driven by regular white folks.
So your book was published in 2003.
Yep.
Any plans for an update on that book?
That book is
because
now
it's
in
changed
the,
a lot.
I know. It's now in the fifth edition.
Okay, so it's been updated.
It has been updated.
All right. So if you were going to write it today, how different would it be? I mean, and I'm wondering.
The last edition came a year ago, and it includes the transition from Obama America to Trump America.
Okay.
From the moment in which we thought we were beyond, and we were post-racial, to now the moment that we are like, oh my goodness, what has happened to our nation? Yeah. And again, like tonight, I'll have a difficult task of trying to discuss what most people don't want to see. Some people believe that we're post-racial. Some people believe that we're now in a moment where old-fashioned racism is in charge. And I'm going to say that both narratives are wrong.
Then what is right?
I'm right.
I'm always right.
I'm always right. Yeah. I think that the bulk of the data, social scientific data on surveys and on practices of race, suggests that since the 1970s, we have had a new way of maintaining sort of race privilege. And again, it's a now you see it, now you don't system, institutionalized. So, for example, if I want to limit the number of minority applicants in a certain college, I can use an exam such as the GRE or the ACT that we now know that is not a good metric to assess likelihood of doing well in college, but it's still used as a filter, yeah? And it's a filter that is seemingly non-racial, even though now we have data suggesting that those tests are racially and class biased. So they discriminate against folks of color, but they also discriminate about poor against poorer people.
Do you feel like, I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it kind of feels like we've had a pendulum swing. I mean, does that hold any water in sociological discussions?
I think that we, systems, whether it's, think about capitalism or patriarchy as a social system, and in this case, racism as a social system, they go through ebbs and flows, yeah? So the assumption that, okay, now we have capitalism, that's it. No, capitalism has gone through ebbs and flows, moments in which it's a little bit more fair and moments that is more in your face, but still the fundamentals don't change much, yeah? So in terms of racism, I think that we are now in a moment of ebb and flow. We were in a moment like this in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, yeah? So the moment today is somewhat similar to those of us of a certain age who remember the Reagan years, 1980 to 1988. Lots of racial animosity, president giving green lights by making comments and statements that then signify to the population, it's okay to say, to be white and say all kinds of things, yeah? So similar to Trump today making the similar problematic remarks, yeah? So, yes, there is an element of change, but the issue is analytically understand that we still have this new moment that emerged in the 1970s, and that moment, racially speaking, has not changed. The fundamentals remain. What has changed is this ebb and flow of the racial order, which is typical. I mean, this is, again, I use capitalism and patriarchy as examples that you can have the parameters being about the same, yet have fluctuations, yeah.
How do economics play into this? It seems like when we go into a recession, we don't talk about it too much. When we start pulling out of that recession, and we just got done having hard times, and we've just gone through it, it seems like the racism issue really kind of flares up. And the same thing happened. You know, we had the downturn in the 70s, and then in the Reagan era, we were starting to come back economically. As soon as it seems like, and I'm just guessing here, when we come into an economic recovery, the resentments come to the surface and the racial anger comes out.
That is true, but we have to make a statement. For people of color, we have been in recession forever, yeah? So let's be clear that what you're talking is when white folks suffer a bit, then they do find scapegoats. And usually is, so interestingly, the reason for the suffering of the white masses is not people of color, it's not women, it's not gay and lesbians, it's corporate America. Yet, they are not hitting corporate America. They are hitting women, gays and lesbians, people of color. We are their scapegoats. That's what I want to have that conversation, that political engagement, to suggest, folks, I feel your pain. It is true that you are suffering. Now, I want to tell you, we have been suffering for a long time. When you guys have a 6-7% unemployment rate, we have a 12% unemployment rate. Today, President Trump is happy that black folks' unemployment rate is in the 7%. Of course, he forgets to say that for whites, it's 3.5. So exactly. Historically, we always have twice the level of unemployment than white folks have.
Yeah. Well, we have to leave it there for now because we've run out of time, but I want to thank our guest, Dr. Eduardo Bonilla Silva. He's the author of the textbook used in the white racism class at FGCU. His talk on the continuing significance of colorblind racism in Trump America will be held at 6 p.m. tonight in the Cohen Center Ballroom on FGCU's campus. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone and Mike Kinnairy. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.